You are now listening to CJSS 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hello, welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. On this week's show, the Shipyards Christmas Market is going strong and hopes to inspire more BC Christmas markets across the Lower Mainland.
There's been a lot of people that are like, oh, you're competing against the Vancouver one. And I've never seen them as a competition because I believe there is more enough space for more.
A seasonal question for you. Is it green to get lit? What is the environmental impact of lighting up a large Christmas trees? The region of Kitchener-Waterloo wonders.
The trees that people come forward with are all ones that they're planning to remove anyways, and there's nothing stopping them from doing that. So the way we look at it is we're able to capture that.
The Astor Theatre Society in Liverpool, Nova Scotia will have a new chairman. Eric Golden will take on the job.
I'm amazed at this building and the history behind it and so on. I think it's got a lot of growth.
To New Brunswick, where the Vogue Cinema may live again as a theatre, a local group meets up with the new owners.
John is very keen to see the Vogue remain as a theater. So now we're in discussions to see how we can arrive at helping him make that happen.
And the Altered Minds Computer for Life program funding challenges threaten the organization's work.
We really want to build an inclusive economy where everybody's voice is heard. We need to have equal opportunities for everyone in terms of technology, access to technology, and digital skills.
Welcome to Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hey, thanks for being with us again this week. As many of us are getting ready to take off in the next few weeks, some of you are already on vacation, I'm sure. We are starting to feel the Christmas pressure and spirit. Yes, we're late bloomers, and it will show this week as we will circle around the end-of-year festivities. And we'll start at the eastern end of the country. The Astor Theatre Society in Liverpool will have a new chairman in the new year. Eric Golden will take over on January 1st as head of the board. Mr. Golden is a community volunteer and retired entrepreneur, originally from Ontario. Golden says he's looking forward to the next few years. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
The Astor Theatre Society will have a new chairman. Eric Golden will take over on January 1st. The resident of Beach Meadows is a community volunteer and retired entrepreneur. Since buying a house here with his wife Karen in 2013, he has developed and restored many older buildings on Liverpool's Main Street and in Milton. He's been a full-time Queens County resident since September 2020. At an event at the Astor last week, Golden told QCCR he's looking forward to heading the theater's board of directors for the next few years.
I'm amazed at this building and the history behind it and so on. I really feel that if we can stabilize, say, a lot of the operational side of things, I think it's got a lot of growth, and I think it's going to be very, very welcoming and a safe place for everybody.
Golden will be taking over from John Simmons, who has been chairman since September 2020. He will continue on the board as past chairman. Simmons helmed the board through COVID and helped revitalize the theater in the past few years. He was also chairman during some turmoil at the theater in the past year with the resignation of popular director and producer Ashley Rose Goodwin. But Simmons said the community is once again rallying around the Astor, and he said he's looking forward to working with Golden and the rest of the board.
And we have a good board that's, they're communicating amongst themselves very well. So I think we will do some good things, and it's onward and upward. So we're excited.
I'm Rick Conrad.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
And next door in Sackville, New Brunswick, we learned from Erica Butler that the Vogue Cinema, which closed in 2023, may live again as a theater thanks to local groups working with the new owners. Thaddeus Alonia of the Chantramar Cultural Collective says the group has met with John Ernst, one of the new owners of the 78-year-old cinema. Alonia says what the group hopes to see happen with the Vogue is very abstract at the moment. moment, but the collective will work towards, quote, a cultural venue that many people can use, end quote. Erica Butler has more on this.
A local group that had been organizing for the possible purchase of the Vogue Cinema in downtown Sackville to reopen it as a community-run cultural venue is now working with the new owner of the beloved cinema. On October 17th, partners John Ernst and Tyler Gay, who also own the former Mel's Tea Room building on the, and the wood block across the street, purchased the Vogue for $110,000. CHMA sat down with Tanshamar Cultural Collective founder Thaddeus Halonia in the busy Cranewood Cafe and Bakery on Monday to learn more.
There has been developments with the Vogue.
Well, the Vogue was sold to John Ernst and his partner, and so consequently we've met with them a couple of times, and John is very keen to see the Vogue remain as a theater and as a cultural space, and so now we're in discussions to see how we can arrive at helping him make that happen.
The group that was working, you know, when you were thinking maybe this might be something you could take on, purchase the building and develop an art center, do you think the scale of what you might do there is similar, or you know, was that still?
Yeah, I think that's very abstract at the moment. I think that the idea is by the Tanshamar Cultural Collective is to continue on the journey of trying to make the Vogue into a cultural venue that many people can use. And obviously my interest in cinema is to bring the Sackville Film Society back to Sackville.
Okay, yeah, you've been in Amherst for a while now.
Yeah, well, this is our second season, so yeah.
Let's gauge your confidence level. I guess there's not too many details you have right now. We're doing something, but how, you know, do you feel positive? How do you feel?
Yeah, you know, I always feel positive. Things are moving forward, and so we can only hope that the interior of the Vogue is fixed up to the standards that we need it to be at, because it's been abandoned for a couple of years now, and that's not good for a building. And then we have to think about what we need to carry on presenting things, films or sound events or whatever that would be. We don't know what that would be, but yeah. So I think I feel very positive.
That's Thaddeus Halonia of the Tanshamar Cultural Collective. The Vogue stopped operating in May of 2023 and went up for sale shortly thereafter. The property was due to go to tax sale by the province in January before it was purchased by Ernst & Gay in October. Ernst is the son of Evelyn and David Ernst, who own Terra Beata Cranberries and co-own Atlantic Auto Cold, also known as The Cube. This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
Well, some get the job and others decide to quit. In Ontario, the artistic director of the Regent Theatre decided to step down. This in front of concert goers who were excited to be at the Regent Theatre in Picton to hear singer Miss Emily perform her Christmas concert. But the mood drastically changed when Alexandra Shea announced that she will be stepping down due to funding shortfalls. The Regent is a heritage building. It was a fledgling theater when Alexandra took over in December 2019. Alexandra Shea was instrumental in the renovation of the nonprofit theater, nurturing community support, and creating solutions for programming that includes the 2024 inaugural County Adaptation Film Festival. Brenda Little in Picton, Ontario, met with her after the show as she recalls all that's been done over the last few years.
The Regent Theater in Picton was filled with concert goers excited to hear Juno-nominated and homegrown R&B singer Miss Emily. She raised the roof with her powerful performance, but the mood suddenly changed when Alexandra Say, artistic director for the Regent, announced to the audience that she is stepping down from the position.
As a result of funding shortfalls, the Regent Theater is no longer able to support the continuance of two full-time positions. Effective today, I'm stepping down as artistic director.
Between 2019, December 9th, 2019, which was my very first day, and now, there was approximately $1.5 million raised that went into this building. And then that was, as I said from the stage, is thanks to our community and our community of support. And so everything from redesigning our lobby bar to our accessible seating, which we didn't have a lot of before, and now we have accessible seating terraces, to the complete renovation of the auditorium from the floors to the seats to the walls, to the theatrical equipment being upgraded. Some of the changes are invisible to the naked eye, things like motorizing grids and new lighting fixtures. But there have been massive changes here, and I take an enormous amount of pleasure in the response that artists have to this place when they come here now. Because that was my goal when I arrived, to make this a place where artists would be proud to come back. And we're seeing that. And we saw that today with Miss Emily. She's been here since the beginning of the beginning. And that's a real testament to the Regent's place in this community. So there's those physical upgrades that have been very significant. And then over the last year, while I've been the artistic director, there have been a lot of programming achievements as well. CAF is the most obvious one. And people are still talking about it, which is the best possible thing for the festival and for the Regent. It was designed to work with partners across the county to increase the visibility and create collaboration opportunities in the off season, and we did that. And more than that, we actually made money for the Regent Theatre, which was the goal. And the fact that a first year festival can do that is remarkable. And part of that is about programming, and part of that is building on the success of the programming that already existed here at the Regent. And it continues.
That was Brenda Little speaking with Alexander Shea, Artistic Director of the Regent Theatre in Ontario. We're leaving the theatre scene now and turning to Winnipeg, Manitoba, where funding challenges for the Altered Minds Computer for Life program continue to threaten the sustainability of the organization's work. The program, launched in 2019, now offers 10 monthly classes, delivering computer literacy support for newcomers, seniors, youth, and low-income individuals. Before the pandemic, Altered Minds was renowned for its entry program, a four-week orientation that supported over 5,000 newcomers annually in Manitoba. However, core federal funding was lost during the pandemic. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
The sound of clicking keys echoes around the room. Engaged faces look up from their screens as an instructor walks them through an online job application, digital forms, and how to attach links and attachments to an email. Despite the growing demand for computer services, with a waitlist of over 200 applicants, funding challenges continue to threaten the sustainability of Altered Minds' work. Before the pandemic, Altered Minds was renowned for its entry program, a four-week orientation that supported over 5,000 newcomers annually to life in Manitoba. However, core federal funding was lost during the pandemic, and the organization dramatically downsized. Despite these funding cuts, the organization shifted the focus to its Computers for Life program to provide essential computer literacy support for newcomers, seniors, youth, and low-income individuals. The initial launch in 2019 included just two classes per month. Today, it offers 10 monthly classes and reaches remote and rural communities, including Indigenous seniors in Morris. Securing funding continues to be the biggest challenge Altered Mind faces, explains Executive Director Yulia Savchuk. Computers for Life operates on funding secured through diverse sources, including contributions from the Winnipeg Foundation, CIBC, and New Horizons for Seniors. However, Savchuk warns there are challenges on the horizon.
For now, for example, this program can exist only till March 31st, 2025. April 1st, we can either stop the program or we can, if there's funding available, we can continue.
Asking for a cost to attend this program is not an option, exclaims Savchuk, with many of the clients who attend these programs coming from marginalized communities, and many are low income. She states additional barriers will prevent clients from obtaining the necessary tools to navigate a digital world.
Clients stop using online services and they become more vulnerable and more frauds are happening. They're not able to apply for jobs, like unemployment rate might grow because of that. And, you know, it's just like non-inclusive economy, you know, because we really want to build an inclusive economy where everybody, his voice is heard. So to make it happen, we need to have equal opportunities for everyone in terms of technology, access to technology, and digital skills.
Many volunteers who work as interpreters or lead Altered Minds programming can attest to the success of these programs, having been clients and students themselves. Mohammed Tayyir Usman volunteered with Altered Minds as an Arabic interpreter in the Computers for Life classes. He says he learned a lot from these classes, and seeing how some of his classmates struggled with English, he wanted to get involved to support them in their learning, knowing how vital these skills are.
Today, having a computer or knowing how to deal with a computer is the most important thing. And as a newcomer, there's a lot of students, a lot of people come in and register in the Ultra Mining organization, and they don't know how to deal with a computer before. And I know a lot of people, they have been registered and taking a course and then enhancing themselves as well, how to open and how to do, how to deal with a computer, how to write, how to make a file folder, and a lot of things. So in this way, I see this organization is going to help a lot of newcomers, and it's a great opportunity for them to come and learn and enhance themselves.
Usman explains the benefits of these programs are multifaceted. Not only are they learning about the basics of computers and navigating the internet, but they're also learning English while building relationships and community.
I recommend a lot of newcomers. I am very close to them. They still calling me and to register themselves to get in this program to learn how to use a computer or how to deal. So I'm quite sure that a lot of newcomers, they are still asking me in this program. So I think it is very effective program, and it's very great because it's going to help them to know how to deal with computer or increasing their abilities.
Despite ongoing challenges, Altered Minds remains committed to adapting the program to meet the unique needs of a diverse clientele. Savchuk notes digital literacy is not a luxury, but a necessity, and they require continued support from volunteers, donors, and partners to maintain their ongoing services. I'm Ryan Funk.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
And it's already that time of year again, and many of us will be making a stop at our local Christmas market to shop for gifts or just to have fun. In BC, the Shipyard's Christmas Market, located in the Lower Lonsdale area of North Vancouver, has been experiencing a surge in popularity in its very first year. And that might be because it has no entry fee. This is something that is extremely important to the market's founding organizer, John Van Rye, and part of the reason he decided to start this project. Danny Nesvadirani in Burnaby, BC, took a bite at this story.
From sizzling spatzle to bratwurst on the grill, the Shipyard's Christmas Market, located in the Lower Lonsdale area of North Vancouver, provides a unique gastronomic experience for those attending, all without an entrance fee, something that has become rare at many Christmas markets throughout the Lower Mainland. This is the market's very first year. Once we arrived at the market, we were able to speak with John Van Rye, one of the market's founding organizers. During our conversation, we were able to learn of his motivations as well as grievances that led him to start the shipyard's Christmas market.
I was frustrated, and I think a lot of people are, that entertainment is costing more and more money. So a lot of people are struggling with rent, mortgages, putting food on the table. If you are getting divorced, or if you're a senior, or are you becoming disabled, it's extremely hard to come by these days. And then when you want entertainment, it costing a fortune, and it's getting more and more expensive each day. And a lot of the entertainment in the Lower Mainland are pretty heavily priced. Like, you know, you pay maybe for a market $22, but, you know, you go to a hockey game, costs you a couple of $100 just for one person. Go to a Taylor Swift concert, see what that costs, right? So it was definitely a frustration of my part, and also because I'm European, I'm from Amsterdam, I know that Christmas market is supposed to be free. So that was something that I thought, like, you know, I think that Christmas markets, especially Christmas, should be accessible to everybody, regardless of what your income is or your social status or anything like that.
According to Van Rij, despite this being the market's first year and starting recently on November 29th, the market has proven to be extremely popular within the past couple of weeks.
Oh, it's been phenomenal. I was very nervous. On Friday, when we opened, I was like, well, you know, did people know about us? Like, you know, did the word get out and everything else? And then on Friday, we just got slammed. It was really, really busy. Saturday and Sunday, exactly the same. All the vendors were like, okay, well, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday will be a lot more relaxed, with markets do in general anyways. But then once it gets dark, the lights go on, and especially around dinner time, it really picked up. And when I listen to the vendors, everybody's really pleasantly surprised. It's much busier than we expected. But like I said, last weekend was absolutely phenomenal. We were packed.
Later on, Van Rij goes over some of the challenges that come across when creating a brand new Christmas market.
What happens is our market's been put together this year within 6 months. And it should be taking a year, but it's been 6 months. There are certain things that are part of this market that normally needs a long approval time. There's people who are inspecting things, there are people that need to be part of it. And especially when you talk about bureaucrats, obviously, you know, they take their time, right? And they have their procedures, and some of these procedures can take a long time. So that's basically what we've been fighting against, right? Like, we've constantly been trying to fast track things, which is not something they're used to. Some people perhaps are not really willing to do that. So we have our struggles, but overall I would say that it's been very positive.
Lastly, Van Rij spoke about his hopes for the Shipyard's Christmas Market to inspire more Christmas markets to open up throughout the Lower Mainland.
Definitely, I think that there's room for it, right? Like, there's been a lot of people that said, like, oh, you're competing against the Vancouver one. And I've never seen them as the competition, because I believe there is more enough space for more, right? Especially if you got 2.8 million people, right? There's more enough space for this. But yeah, at the same time, I think, like, you know, if you're looking at further down in the valley, like, you know, in the Chilliwack, Mission, and Agassiz area, like that kind of areas, past Abbotsford, or maybe Abbotsford included, sure, there should be another one right there. Well, maybe I will take that initiative, but I don't see why somebody else couldn't do it. But I hope, though, and if they do it, that they do it for free. Free admission. Because I think that's really keen. I mean, they do it the rest of the world. I don't see why, you know, here in Canada, we have to have a pay-to-play kind of model.
The Shipyard's Christmas Market will be going on until December 24th, 2024. And while this is the first year that this market is being held, plans are in place to continually improve the experience for those that attend, as well as to hopefully inspire more Christmas markets throughout the Lower Mainland. Danny Nesvedarani, this piece would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
You're tuned to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
Every year, cities in the region of Waterloo harvest and display large Christmas trees for their communities. But is cutting down large trees for the sake of the Christmas spirit the best option for the environment? In many communities, the Christmas season is kicked off with a city tree lighting ceremony where a large Christmas tree is lit up for all to see. But some may be wondering if cutting down 30-foot giants is the best choice. So, is it green to get lit? Journalist Leah Gerber speaks with the City of Waterloo Manager of Forestry and Horticulture, Derek Brick, about the pros and cons of cutting down a large tree every year, and also with one resident who donated this year's Christmas tree.
Friday night, the lights went on across the region as Kitchener, Cambridge, and Waterloo all hosted their tree lighting ceremonies to usher in the Christmas season. Derek Brick is the manager of forestry, horticulture, and cemeteries at the City of Waterloo. His department oversees the selection and installation of the city's large Christmas trees in the Waterloo Public Square every year. He says this year's tree is about 30 feet high.
This tree is just one piece. We decorate all of our flower boxes and that throughout the whole King Street area. So as we start doing that, staff run into people as they're setting up, and there's typically the comments are all excitement about this season.
A large sparkling tree in a central location is a beloved holiday tradition for many communities. But in these environmentally tough times, some might be asking if it's the best option. On social media posts about the Christmas tree installations in Kitchener and Cambridge, some commenters wondered if it's time to stop cutting down these big trees. All three cities' trees are typically donated by residents who planned to take them down anyway, says Brick.
As much as we want to protect our urban forest and maintain it, the trees that people come forward with are all ones that they're planning to remove anyways, and there's nothing stopping them from doing that. So the way we look at it is we're able to capture that and use the tree and make it valuable to us for about two month period of time that it sits in the square.
This year, Waterloo's tree was donated by Rob Hofkamp.
This tree's been on our home since we moved in 1998. And it's pretty big, so it was time to... We used to decorate it, actually, for our children, but it's impossible to decorate now, so I thought, well, let's donate it to the city.
When asked how he feels about his family's tree serving as the city's Christmas tree this year, Hofkamp responded,
It's exciting, and I've got all of our grandchildren will go down there and see it decorated this year, and they'll know where it came from.
A report from Montreal-based private research firm Ellipsos compared the life cycles of real and artificial Christmas trees. They found that while the use of real Christmas trees is harder on local ecology, artificial trees were a bad choice for the climate and resource depletion due to how far they are transported and the materials used to create them. Artificial trees typically end up in landfills. When asked if the City of Waterloo has considered using an artificial tree, Brick responded,
"Just based on the sheer size, the availability of artificial trees at that size is pretty difficult, and it comes at a high cost. And artificial trees, they also have an impact in terms of the materials that you use, and they don't last forever either. So I think at this time, with the number of trees that are offered as donations to the city, we haven't considered the artificial."
Brick says Waterloo's tree will stay up for about 2 months before being cut up and mulched.
The branches and that will go through our chipper, and they get added to our wood chip pile, which we use throughout the city for mulching pathways and things like that, flower beds. And then the body wood, if there's larger body wood, it'll go into our pile of body wood, which typically goes to the various people for firewood.
I'm Leah Gerber.
And that's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists, Leah Gerber, Brenda Little, Ryan Funk, Erica Butler, Rick Conrad, and Danny Nesvadirani. National editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. And do we need to say it? Thanks to your radio station. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Happy to have you with us. And until next week, ciao.
Montreal, British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.